We were talking when the tape ended about the situation in Biafra and in Nigeria and the University of Nigeria.
Yeah. The University of Nigeria was focused on local things from the beginning. When the secession came, no, they didn't really want it. President Ezekwe was against it, and but he was in Lagos at the time. But they had had a coup. They had a military coup in which, in every district, a military officer was in charge, and one Colonel Ojukwu was in charge of the former eastern region. And there was a general who was in charge, General Cowan, of the whole country, and so we had a military government for a while. And so things were a little bit raunchy anyway. They all supported the idea of the University of Nigeria. We had helped get two universities started in the north, at Kaduna and at Kano and at Ife. So by then there, and this, I'm talking less than 7 years, here was the old Ibadan, the classical British model school, mm-hmm. and then at Nsukka, the University of Nigeria, which was supposed to be trying to do for that country what they needed, teaching about their needs and interests. And these others got started too, and they sort of mixed it up. When things got tough and the people in national government wanted to control the East and the other places, they started a blockade of the East. And they said, you know, the East produces a lot of palm oil and ships it out. They don't have salt. They were bringing that in from outside. And meat usually came down from the north, because up in the north, although on our campus we had cattle and some Fulani people from the north who were running our herds, and a professor from here who was doing animal husbandry, the governor of Nigeria set up a blockade around that whole enclave that was then the eastern region, and said, now you behave and do things our way, or we're going to starve you to death. And it wasn't going too well. I think of, for one thing, you can't export your palm oil, so you don't have cash income coming in. You got lots of palm oil, because it keeps coming off the trees, produce palm kernels, and everybody in their house can cook those and stamp them with their feet and make oil out of them. But you need salt. So salt is being smuggled across the Niger River. And unfortunately, or fortunately, the whole country had just built this beautiful bridge across the Niger River at a place called Onitsha, from the east to the Midwest, as it was then called, where Benin is. And it was like the building of the Mackinac Bridge. And for years we watched it getting built, and finally it got built, and it was going to make everything better on both sides. But it wasn't long after that that this blockade started. And the military took over the bridge and wouldn't let anybody cross, and all kind of things like that. We could still get across. The school in Ibadan on the east side, where there was a boarding school, three countries, the Americans, the British, and the Nigerians together. I had two kids in that school, and some of our other people had kids there. We could, with our sort of diplomatic community, semi-diplomatic, not officially, could get back and forth. But increasingly, we were reducing our operations for the whole project. And although we had 30 families there and about four maybe short-term visitors, when the fighting started in our area, let's put it that way. Prior to that, the U.S. government had sent a diplomat to my home with a big mail bag. Now, mail could be sent back and forth in a diplomatic pouch, and the Nigerian government never interfered with them. It goes from Washington to Lagos. He came with two of these diplomatic pouches, and I was down in my office on the campus, and I was called to go back to my home, and these guys were sitting in the dining room. I remember two of them. They had come from Washington or somewhere, and they were going to install a two-way radio in my home. Now, since the government of Nigeria said it shouldn't be done, and the new government in the East, and the government in the Eastern region didn't want it done anywhere, this was going to be quiet, let's say clandestine. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say anything about it to anybody, and we looked it over in my room, in our bedroom upstairs. There was one shelf, and we built a sort of cabinet out of that so the radio could stay in there, and I would only open it up to talk on the radio also. But they ran an aerial across from my house to the one that Bob Dean's professor of animal science here, who's now retired, he was living then next door to us, and they run this great big red wire across with a black wire coming down the middle. Now, anybody who knows about shortwave radio, we had this single sideband radio installed in our bedroom, and every day I was supposed to go there and get online with Lagos and exchange information. But since it wasn't licensed or approved, we did it only 15 minutes, and we kept changing the time. So tomorrow is going to be a different time today. And that was interesting, and I think it lasted less than 6 months. We didn't publicize it when it happened, so I don't know exactly. I know when it ended. Because the evacuation of we had sort of evacuation plans which never came to fruition, because on a certain day, maybe in May
of
1967.
67, okay.
I got word on my radio that all the women and children were to be evacuated. We were to have a motor pool, and we could take the British and the Dutch who were with us if we wanted, if they were willing to go, and all the Peace Corps volunteers from our area should go with us, and we should all drive all the way down to Port Harcourt, where there was a big airport, and a plane would come there like in 2 days. And each one was to have only 6 pounds of luggage, and they said, incidentally, I said, what about the men? No, just the women and children, because we want the men to stay there and pretend that you're doing business as usual at the same old stall and nothing's going wrong. They didn't want them to think the Americans think that things are going to get worse, so you stay there. But take all the women and children. And again, that would take me 2 hours. I'm not going to waste your time with that. But we organized a sort of carpool. All of our team, of course, went. They had no choice. Just the women and the children. And most of them had cars, and they drove in this long line. And the Dutch agreed, and they came with us, and their cars were also in that line with ours. Most of the British didn't come. They didn't want anything to do with us, and they thought they knew better anyhow. There weren't many. Mm-hmm. There were some. And the Peace Corps volunteers, they came to my home the day before we were going, and they said, they didn't want to go. I said, we didn't want to go either. But, you know, we have to go. It's not a matter of choice. And then they would say, you know, we volunteered to do this thing. We're going to stay. So I ended up we had one Chevrolet carryall that had our baseball equipment on the campus there every afternoon, every Sunday afternoon, we had a baseball game. There were cricketers and baseballers playing together. And you could see them when they came to bat because they held the bat differently.
Different style.
And that was our big recreation of the week. Now, I've skipped some time because after the first 5 years of commuting, my whole family, four little kids, Mark and I, moved to Nigeria and we lived there for the next 2 years.
So what range were your children, let's say, when you got there?
The baby was maybe 13 months or okay. Something like that. And the next one was maybe fourth or fifth grade. And the other two were in high school.
They were so certainly formative years.
Yeah, those were formative years. My daughter, the oldest, it was her junior year at East Lansing High. She didn't want to go. So we made a deal with her. She could go for the junior year and come back for her senior year. And that's what she did. Our son stayed for the whole 2 years, got to be a soccer player, later played varsity soccer in a U.S. college. Mm-hmm. So we had those little kids and we stayed there. A lot of other things happened at any time, but now going to finish the story of the evacuation, because in May at a certain time they wanted us to do it on Sunday, and the plane was going to come to Port Harcourt on Monday, and they wanted us to be all down at a hotel there by Sunday night, and they thought it'd be better if we go on Sunday, it wouldn't be as visible to all the students. And, well, you can't hide a thing like that, you know. But we had a continuing education center there, modeled after the one here. It wasn't called a Kellogg Center, but Gordon Belson, the same architect who had designed the Kellogg Center in the beginning, came to Africa and helped us design that program out of local materials as much as possible. And we started a continuing education center, a very significant part of our total strategy of relating education to the real world. But there we were, ready to organize. We met at the continuing education center in its parking lot. Each family is supposed to be there at a certain time. We had walkie-talkies. So we set it up that the driver of the first car has one, and then every sixth car had one, and I stayed in the last car with one. And we could sort of manage things. We knew what route we were going to take. It was a drive that took maybe 6 hours. And we all went down to Port Harcourt, stayed in that hotel. And the next morning, the plane came, and our families And it wasn't a U.S. official plane or anything. It was an oil company plane, because we had oil there then, and one of the oil companies had loaned their plane to the embassy, and that they flew the plane out there. And each person got on and had to step on a scale and get weighed. And our luggage was limited to 6 pounds.
6 pounds.
And some of the women didn't want to do that in public. So we set it up so that nobody has to watch as you get weighed, but somebody was paying attention. Because when the plane was full, they were going to stop it and the rest would go on another batch. They had other people being evacuated besides the so-called Michigan State group.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, all of our women and children got on the plane. And the men lined up on the other side of the fence and watched the runway. And I was thinking, gee, here I got, we didn't have quite 30 people. We had some short-termers still there. We had, you know, one short-term, one of our deans had traveled out with his wife while she had to go, and he stayed, even though they were only there for a few weeks. And I was worried about the morale problem. And as the plane lifted off the runway, one gentleman, Bob Carollis from Horticulture, said, "Now we can play poker every night." Because before that, he was only allowed to play like twice a week, and there was a group to pay. And that broke the ice. Everybody started laughing. We, not really celebratory, but we all drove back to, and some had it more difficult than others, mm-hmm. adjusting to that. And they landed in Lagos, and somebody walked onto the plane and said, "Is Mrs. Axon here?" Well, I was the so-called team leader, mm-hmm. and therefore, and they the official people wanted to negotiate who's going to fly out next and where are they going. And so she spent that whole day realizing that, well, you know, none of us wanted to leave in the first place. So she mm-hmm. went to the office of the aid mission director. When I got there some months later, he sat in his office. He looked at his ceiling and he says, "You know, we've got it painted over now, but there was a big black hole there where Nancy went through the roof when she was here telling me all the reasons why we shouldn't be doing this thing."
That's interesting.
Anyway, they organized, you know, the youngest children first. Some people wanted to go to Europe. They had not finished their 18 months of service, which is a minimum to get tax exemption, so they wanted to stay there and meet their husbands later. Mm-hmm. All of us thought, you know, this thing was going to blow over in a few weeks, we'd all go back, so it isn't not neat if you're going to stay and finish out your tour. Others went back to the United States. Few of them, unfortunately, got routed through Cairo on their way to Europe to come back, because they were filling up all kind of planes, mm-hmm. and the Six-Day War broke out.
In 67.
They got evacuated twice. But anyway, women and children came back. I'll tell you two little stories about that, and then let's get on to the rest of MSU's glorious international history. On the 3rd of July of 1967, our team was getting a little bit nervous, and things were more or less okay, but we'd given our final exams for the semester, and you know, students stayed. It was amazing how well the students had hung in there and stayed and got their, wrote their papers and got graded and so on, and many of the faculty stayed. Those from other parts of Nigeria had gone to the other parts, and others came there, and I won't get into all the details of the turbulence in Nigeria, which was then and is now and maybe ever more shall be. However, back on the campus, there was a military detachment there, and some of us played tennis every afternoon. That was our main recreation, and I invited the colonel who was in charge of that to join us, and he did some of the time, so we got fairly well acquainted. And he was wanting information from me, and I was wanting information from him, and things were getting sort of turbulent, and he knew that. And I went to my radio that day, and the rest of the Michigan State group went to the house of Andy Doyle, who was sort of the deputy team leader at the time. And I got on my radio, and they told, you know, their information says the Northern Army is moving in your direction. And we were like 6 miles from the northern border. And we're not sure what they're going to do when they get there, but we just wanted you to be informed, and if we find out, well, we'll let you know. So I said, as usual, "What time are we going to meet on the radio tomorrow?" He said, "Oh, we can't meet tomorrow because the embassy's closed." I said, "What? The embassy's closed?" He said, "Yes, it's the 4th of July, and the ambassador's having his 4th of July party, but we'll be on the 5th. I can't tell you or anybody in public what I said, but I had to walk across the street then and meet the MSU team and explain that. It was not a happy moment. Anyway, on the 7th of July, the first shells came through the ceiling of the Princess Alexandra Auditorium, one of our most lettered, and the group evacuated to Enugu, which we've been planning to do long before. They waited there for a while, and gradually everybody filtered back here. And that was Queen of Michigan. The state was very good to us. They financially, you know, you got families coming back. They rented their house. They got two kids or something like that. They're coming back to East Lansing. What are they going to do? And we designated in our business office a pots and pans allowance. That was what we called it. Now, not much of that is where the auditors can find it. And we set up a pots and pans allowance so that, you know, if you get back with the new baby, you got to buy some diapers right away. And you need some pots and pans. You need some, if you're staying with a relative or a friend or your department chair for here is taking you in or whatever. And they made all kinds of different arrangements for the various families. But yes, MSU set up a pots and pans allowance to unofficially cover the unintended and unwanted expenses. And yes, and over a period of a few months, we eventually cleaned up everything. People were welcomed back into their departments one way or another. And, mm-hmm. and these were sort of not employees that you hired to do this. These were our own faculty. We did have some people from other universities that we brought, and that was another complication. But basically, it's our own faculty, because the rationale that President Hanna announced from the beginning, we're sending our faculty abroad so they can learn about the rest of the world, as I was saying earlier, so they won't make the mistakes that the other generation. We want them to know about that place. Yes, they should teach and be helpful while they're there, but the main goal is they should be back here in the classroom facing U.S. students, sharing their perspective of the world that they didn't have before. And, you know, in that sense, it had to end sooner or later. I was miserable that it ended when it did, but it did, and, mm-hmm. and that was that.
Was anyone injured in that evacuation?
None of our staff were injured in any way. Psychologically, I think one or two really never got over it. Mm-hmm. And I think of one in particular, but that may have been, you know, personal anyway. We had one death, not at the evacuation, but earlier. Someone had taken an overdose of malaria pills inadvertently, and that was a big problem. We had prepared in a way because in the veterinary college we had one shelf that I had arranged to have reserved in a cold room in case we had a body. Mm-hmm. And I didn't announce that to anybody. These are not the things you advertise.
No.
And on one occasion in the whole 7 years we used that shelf. Mm-hmm. And it was a bit of a challenge, and the embassy was very good. They sent out two body bags, and then we had to take that hot food home with the body and the spouse of that person. Mm-hmm. And it was one of many, many memorable occasions. George Johnson at one point, who had been dean of the law school at Howard University, very active in the civil rights movement, well known to President Hanna in his work on the Civil Rights Commission, and he recruited George Johnson to come out and be our vice chancellor. And Glenn Taggart went home after his short term, and George stayed for at least 2 years, and he was excellent. And we had some turbulent moments, you know, like when at one point this particular story, he was gone. I was acting vice chancellor, and the faculty association, like the union of the clerical and technical and kitchen people on the campus, were annoyed over some incident. And they came marching to the vice chancellor's office where I was sitting, carrying palm leaves and drumming on drums. And one by one, my colleagues said they had to go, they couldn't stay. I mean, my secretary walked in and he said he was very sorry, but he had to leave. He didn't want to be seen here when they got there. Uh-huh. And my driver came by and said, "If you don't mind, sir, I want to move your car to another place because I don't want it to get damaged. But of course, you stay there." And fortunately, I had been for a while the registrar, and I had worked with the personnel and had helped both of those unions get there. We had a catering workers union and a clerical workers union, I guess. I had helped them both draft their articles and whatever and worked with them over the years, and I'd been there over the 7 years on and off by then. Mm-hmm. Because that was near the end, maybe it was 6 years by then. And I remember standing on top of a trash can so that their union leader could get on it, because he was smaller than me, and tell them his speech. And then I climbed up on the trash can and reminded them of things, and they peacefully marched home. And this was long before the evacuation. But then George Johnson used to say, yes, you know, it's over now, and that'll be one of those memorable occasions. Now, in your life, there'll be several memorable occasions, and this is one more, mm-hmm. being a positive person. Well, I would say that evacuation was one more, and there are some others relating to the things, but Michigan State was very flexible and very helpful, and International Studies and Programs, where I was by then also Assistant Dean of International Studies and Programs, but my main job was coordinator.
No, were you working with Glenn Taggart then, or Ralph Smuckler?
No, Glenn Taggart uh-huh. was still the dean, so quite a ways later. Uh-huh. Ralph Smuckler was there. Ralph was the associate dean, and Glenn was the dean,
okay. And
I was an assistant dean. And that at that point, they changed my title to Assistant Dean for Overseas Operations. And so, for the next year or so, my task was to travel and visit all the other projects, like the one in Nigeria. We had many others, none as big as that, but many others scattered over the world, mm-hmm. and help build morale, recruit staff, and build relationships with the local people, mm-hmm. and things of that sort.
Now, one of the things that came up when I was talking with other people about the Vietnam project, and of course, is the Ramparts article. And was there any fallout? You were in Nigeria at the time. Was there any fallout from that, or let's say a negative reaction to MSU people
later,
worldwide? Or
not while we were there.
Okay.
Not to 1960. There was some, I would say, globally. But, you know, personally, I didn't even know about the Vietnam project. Mm-hmm. We were so deeply immersed in the going back and forth period, and then in the 2 years that my family and I had stayed there, in Nigeria, that was my whole world. Mm-hmm. And I knew we were doing other things because I was also keeping in touch with Glenn Taggart and Ralph Smuckler. Homer Higby was working with international students then. Mm-hmm. And they were all very helpful with the Nigeria program, which was my focus. And also we started the African Study Center, the Asian Study Center, the Latin American Study Center at that time, an Institute for International Communication and the Communication College. We had an institute in the Engineering College, which I don't think is there anymore, and the medical school was just getting started. Some of the medical school starting people came out and visited us there, and we had an institute started then and there. So I was much more involved in these things, but George was Nigeria. It wasn't a matter of, mm-hmm. until after the evacuation. And then when they gave me the new title of Assistant Dean for Overseas Operations, then I started visiting all of these projects, but at that time, the Michigan State, Indiana University, University of Wisconsin, University of Illinois were all having a similar problem with their overseas technical assistance projects. You know, they were all funded in order to do something technical to make things better in that country, whether it was in education or in engineering or in health or in agriculture or whatever. But recruiting staff. Now, President Hanna was really committed to the idea that basically we were trying to educate our staff, help them better prepared to work with our students. And student exchanges were part of it. Even in the Nigeria program, we had a group of students going back and forth several years. Some of the others didn't think that way about it, but they all knew it was hard to staff it. Having 30 full-time faculty members there was larger probably than any of the projects of the others, and larger than any of our current ones by the time we got back. And I think it was an example of the arrogance and the naivete, because we had people who we thought we could send people to do it. We didn't know what the it was. And you see, so it took me 7 years to figure that out, and the others maybe more or less too. So there were smaller projects trying to interact with the local people and figure out what needed to be done and then facilitate the doing of it. A very different strategy. I mean, if you admit in the beginning that you're naive and arrogant, which nobody would admit, but at least you're not knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
Politely, we say we're not knowledgeable of what that world is like, mm-hmm. what the technical aspects of it are, what the social cultural aspects of it, what the political aspects of it are. We took a smaller approach. But even for the smaller approach, like if you're just going to send five people to country X, you got to recruit them. And within any one campus, it was hard to find five people who would go. Now, President Hanna was a great help in the Nigeria program days, because he would help me put pressure on deans and department chairs to let a person go, and would make sure that whoever went, when it came salary administration time, their service abroad was recognized. Mm-hmm. I mean, the salary adjustments would go, as they probably do now, from a department to a dean to maybe a provost, And the president then, he looked at everyone every year. And if they had been in Nigeria, we're still in Nigeria. He himself came several times. He and Sarah Hannah came together once. I had the joy of escorting them around. She became very ill with what we call tummy palaver there. And that was, in retrospect, a marvelous thing. And we were staying in the same building. He was he was downstairs with her, and I was upstairs in my room. There was no water. The water went off. Well, if you've got somebody vomiting all the time and there's no water, you've got a big problem. Mm-hmm. So I had arranged with somebody else who's carrying water, and I'm bringing buckets to the door, and President Hannah's carrying them in to help keep Sarah cleaned up and the room cleaned up and everything. Well, ever since then, you know, we could ask for anything for Nigeria, and Sarah Hannah was our she would do it. Those families are living there for 2 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, they
excuse
had
me just a second.
Okay. Good visits like that, and and then, you know, then my task, being responsible for overseas operations, was to go from campus to campus around the world, wherever we had projects, some in education ministries, and do similar things. And then, but this consortium came along. Nobody had enough staff to do it. So people from these four universities met here in our library building, and our member was Glenn Taggart, but he didn't have a typewriter. I had a typewriter in my office. So I wheeled in my typewriter when he and Roy and Dangerfield from Illinois sat down, and we all worked out the charter, really, for this consortium, Midwest University Consortium for International Activities, Incorporated, MUCIA. And then they took it to Ford Foundation, who were still our friends, and Ford supported it. And that foundation got started, and I was still running around doing other things. About the end of the first year, or toward the end of the first year of MUCIA, Rawdon Dangerfield died. No, he became ill. Because then they needed to hire a replacement. By then, John Hanna was our director of the U.S. Aid Agency in Washington. Mm-hmm. He had left here, Glenn.
Under President Nixon.
Cliff Wharton had come here.
Yeah.
So he was no longer president here. Mm-hmm. But I visited with him one day in Washington. And he didn't say so, but I think he called the board of directors of the thing and said, hey, why don't you guys get George to be the next president and executive director of MUCIA? So they did. And for the next 7 years, well, I agreed to, and the headquarters was the University of Illinois. I agreed to go to Illinois for 1 year and then see, because they didn't want to move the headquarters. They had the bank account there and the financial officer and so forth. At the end, toward the end of the first year, I said, I'm going back to Michigan State next year. For one thing, my wife is teaching part-time there. She can't do that down here. I like to teach, and I could teach up here. I had a friend in one of the departments down there, and he would let me teach a little down there, but, you know, I was really not part of that campus. So I told him, look, I'm going back next year. I'll stay in this job if you move the headquarters there. Otherwise, so they moved the headquarters here. And in my second year, the headquarters moved into our international center here, in room 201, and that became the MUCIA headquarters for the next 6 years.
So this would be, what, 69
to
75?
No, this was sooner. Well, I did it for 7 years. Well.
7 years, okay. Yeah.
Because in the sixth year, at the end of the sixth year, my administrative officer, whose name was Bud Dong, he had served as administrative officer in the international program. So I think maybe he worked in Vietnam with Ralph and Glenn Taggart, and he worked in Nigeria for us for 2 years. And he became the administrative officer of the MUCIA Consortium, and I became the director. I was the director. I left the other administrative people down there, and the two of us managed the MUCIA Consortium for six more years here. But the end of that would be my sixth year of it, 1 year down there and 5 years here. Bud Doan came to me and said, you know, I've done the arithmetic. You were in the air more days than you were on the ground last year. And you were only home here in East Lansing something like one quarter of the time. And I figured that out, and my wife agreed, that's enough. So I went at the next board. The board used to meet once a month. It had members, two from each university. By then it had grown. One of my tasks was to expand it, so Purdue had joined. And University of Minnesota had joined, and one more, I can't remember which one. No. Anyway, and then later Penn State joined. I told the board of directors, look, I'm going at the end of this year. That'll be my seventh year with you, and you better recruit somebody to take my place. And you have to do that, or I can't recruit him for you. And in the meantime, I was working among other projects with one in Nepal, where I did visit projects all over, and I was very much interested in institution building as a phenomenon. And there were some scholars around the United States studying that. You know, the Nigeria project was a case of institution building for them. And I got involved with that, and we had a little small consortium that Ralph Smuckler helped start, of two people from each of four universities really organizing studies of institutional building. When I was in the Musiat post, then with six or seven universities, we decided to go to AID, Washington, and try to get a contract for them for an expanded program in research about institution building. And that, you know, I'm not telling you about my gross failures, I'm only telling you about some of my successes. After a lot of work at the several campuses and in AID, Washington, they gave us a grant of $1 million to start that center. Well, $1 million was more in the 1970s, well, 1960s, that was late 60s. Mm-hmm. And we set up a thing which ended up at Indiana University with representing all the consortium universities doing research on what we were doing, technical assistance, but it was the institution building part that they focused on. And I found myself giving speeches here and there.